I got to tell you a story. So I hung out with your mom because my parents are your parents and your parents are my parents. So I hung out with your parents the other day. I don't know, for anyone that doesn't know this, I'm in real estate on his mom's team, Reese Realty. Okay, so I had my first closing, and so I met with your mom, and we were just kind of talking business and everything, and I had to like hand over some stuff to her, and we ended up talking for like 3.5 hours, and your poor dad was there just like drinking like at the bar. I literally hugged him goodbye, and I was like, thanks for sitting through that. Anyways, we were talking, and your mom, I don't even know how we got on the topic, but your mom started talking. She's like, so my big grandma, we called her Big Grandma, and I was like, wait, really? And then she's like, yeah, Big Grandma, and I had Little Grandma. And I was like, okay. I was like, my mom, who is also Darlene, who is also the second child of five, right?
And the with older an older sister,
Diane, and they're all named D's, correct?
Yep.
They all have D's. Yep, that's my mom. That's the same story. And she had a Big Grandma and a Little Grandma. I swear to God.
No way.
Isn't that insane?
What? Yet.
So your mom had a Big Grandma and Little Grandma, and my mom had a Big Grandma and a Little Grandma. That's literally what they call them.
Oh, I got chills.
It's crazy. I was just like, I feel like we're in an alternate universe and like something like crisscrossed or something. Like, how did our paths cross? Because there's so many parallels. It's so weird.
Forensics.
There it is.
Forensics.
It's the common denominator, and I'm like...
What went from acting is now science.
Although I would take the acting in a heartbeat because this shit is hard.
Okay, ready? 3, 2.
Hi, Dee.
Okay, so I'm back in New York.
Yeah, you are.
And listen, you know that moment when you like try to go to sleep? I'm sure you know this. And then your brain just starts going through everything, yep. Keeps you awake. Well, now like put that with squirrels living in your walls.
No.
Me and my roommate, Jenny, we feel like we're like going crazy. But you know what? All I hear is Taylor Swift's song, Welcome to New York, in my head. I'm like, well, it's been waiting for you. Has it been waiting for me? Have the squirrels been waiting for me? I don't know. I don't know, Taylor, but this is what I'm dealing with.
You want to hear some hot goss about a Midwest talent agency?
Ooh, okay.
So did you sign with the iGroup whenever you were here?
No. What's the iGroup?
The iGroup is a talent agency here. So there was a very, very brief moment where movies and TV were coming to Michigan. Do you remember any of that?
I remember that.
And the iGroup, though, it's been here for years. I don't know all the history, but, you know, it's kind of like the main one. There's the iGroup and Productions Plus. Well, I've been with them forever since I got out of college, I think, or maybe I was still in college. And it's just commercial. It's a lot of commercial stuff that comes through, you know. I got an email that, you know, it was closing. And it was like, it was so weird. So apparently the owner hasn't been paying actors their money. All of a sudden, the money just started disappearing. Actors were doing jobs. They weren't getting paid. So the agents there, apparently they couldn't even get in touch with him. I don't know the status of like where he's at or anything, but they could not get any answers.
What?
And so they literally just decided to like pack everything up. They took the whole roster with them, and without any response or word from the owner, they left and they're opening their own agency.
Kudos to them.
Kudos to them for sure. Like they're doing a great job. They're really standing behind the actors and they're being really honorable about it because it's their name on the line as well. But it was just so wild because this is the big thing. From what I can understand, they don't know where he's at and they haven't been in contact with him, but no one is talking about it. It's not on the news. Not a single article is written about the whole fact that the iGroup, which is the biggest talent agency in Michigan, and this owner is going to have to claim bankruptcy. He has a ton of lawsuits against him. No one's talking about it.
Oh, I'm almost positive if this just happened, this is going to go out soon.
Right. It's just like the friggin' little Nancy Drew in me is just like, I want answers. I want to know where he is. You know, I'm like, where did he go? What is
He's probably P. Diddying it and like got on a plane and left.
I mean, I think they thought he was in Wisconsin or something. So anyways, now what is our drink today from your grandpa's little black book?
Today's 1930s custom cocktail recipe is the Saratoga Fizz. It is made with 1 1/4 ounce of whiskey, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, 1/4 ounce of lime juice, 1 teaspoon of sugar, and 1 egg white. Shake it up, pour it into a glass or my bedazzled mug, and it's good.
All right. Are you ready to get into it?
Let's do it. Hi everyone! Welcome to the Forensic Files Duo Podcast, where we recap, review, and provide updates on the cases featured on the true crime TV show Forensic Files. I'm Drew, and I knew nothing about true crime until we started this podcast.
I'm Danielle, and I consume way too much true crime content for it to be healthy, so at least now I'm doing something productive with that information just swimming around in my brain.
And that something is teaching about all the ways in which real people are monsters in real life, when I was just fine in my naive bubble only being scared of dolls named Annabelle or Samara crawling out of my TV screen.
Now, if you are listening to us for the very first time and want to hear more about our 20-year friendship and how we became the forensics duo many moons ago, head over to episode 1 for that whole backstory.
Now for our regular disclaimer, we understand that we will be discussing a lot of sensitive topics. So although we may laugh at times, please remember that we are laughing at ourselves and ourselves only. We are not making light of what the victims and their families have gone through and may continue to be going through.
And in an effort to use the public's overall interest in the show Forensic Files and leverage the power of digital media, once the episode coverage is over, we will highlight two missing person cases, a case that's currently on the BIA's Missing and Murdered Indigenous People database and another on the Black and Missing Foundation's website.
Today's episode is listed on Wikipedia as Season 1, Episode 4. It's called The Footpath Murders, and it first aired on October 23rd, 1996.
And we are going across the pond to England. This case is very famous because it covers the scientific discovery of DNA and the first time it was ever used in the world to solve a murder.
Well, this is kind of ironic timing because I am now dating someone from across the pond in England, and it's just kind of ironic that this is the episode that we're doing almost immediately following his departure from the States.
I think this is the only episode on Forensic Files that is an international episode, so it was just like the timing was very, very weird.
Now, this case takes place in Narborough, which according to Wikipedia is a large village in the Blaby district of Leicestershire, England. It's a village of about 8,000 people, but it's only 6 miles from Leicestershire, which is apparently the largest city in the East Midlands.
And Reddit did not disappoint with giving me a thoroughly entertaining thread full of opinions on the city of Leicester. Please don't come for me. These are not my opinions or the opinions of our podcast, because personally, I was surprised. It looks very, very beautiful from the photos that I saw, but to each their own. Oil-free egg says, "It's an absolute dive. I was born there, have most of my family still there, and I think it's the pits. And Fosse Park roundabout can fuck off. Fosse Park, Gary, Crisp, and prisons." Then in response to someone who mentions Parva, I don't know what that means, he says, "My dad lives in Parva, comma, not the prison." Then Psycho Mouse says, "I had to endure Leicester for 4 years. It's the worst fucking place on earth." Floating Ostrich, these names, man. Floating Ostrich said, "It has a surprisingly high GDP, which I think is just like money, okay, per capita." And he says, "No fucking idea what industry is causing that." And then My Lovely Horsey says, "It's a place," shrug. And closing us out is Ultra Savage 1978 with "Lovely Cheese."
Lovely cheese.
Lovely cheese. I mean, all the other places, like, it's the worst fucking place on earth. And then I'm like, but the cheese, though.
Well, Leicester, I hope to try your cheese very soon. Now this episode opens up with a reenactment scene made just for me. It's black and white. It's grainy. There's no music. Just Peter's voice.
On a deserted footpath, early on the morning of November 22nd, 1983... a hospital worker witnessed a terrible sight. It would be the first case in the world where DNA evidence helped find the killer.
November 22nd. Okay, pause. This is the third out of our only 8 episodes that we have recorded where the murder has happened in November. Episode 1.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Episode 1, Hella Crafts. Remember, she was murdered on November 19th, which is also the same day we ironically and unintentionally recorded our first episode of this whole entire podcast. And then last episode, Lonnie Turner Sr. was technically murdered on Halloween, which is also the day we decided to even make this podcast. But everything that happened, he was found and all of those things, those occurred on November 1st. And now this case is covering sweet Linda Mann, who was found murdered on, unfortunately, November 22nd. I know. It sticks out because I have so many things that happen in November, like birthdays. So when I hear, like, Blake's birthday is November 21st. So it's like when I hear that, it's like, it's been like ding, ding, ding. So that's why I noticed it.
I will never get over how strange it was to realize that we started this podcast with Hellacraft's Forensic Files episode on the 37th anniversary of her disappearance. Anyways, there's a lot of reenactment footage in this episode. I kept thinking we were further back in time than 1983 because of how much this episode has that sepia/black and white filter. And also, like, the costuming that was in this reenactment was like, I didn't know if I was watching Downton Abbey or Forensic Files.
I agree. I completely agree. I felt that way too. But so we do hear that Nabra isn't the place that anyone would, of course, expect to find a dead body.
It is something you expect to happen in a city, not in a small village community.
I'm not sure why they're acting like they're not super close to a pretty large city. Like, my elementary school was further away from my house than Nabra was to Leicester.
Yeah, I know. And comments like this, they just pop up throughout the entire episode. No one, I mean, no one ever expects it to happen in your city. But if true crime stories have taught us anything, it's that very scary things can happen anywhere. I lived in Koreatown in Los Angeles, and a lot of crazy stuff went down while I lived in the city, but I never saw anyone dead from being shot until I lived in straight up suburbia in a neighborhood that was 30 miles north of Atlanta. That neighborhood looked like it was like a set out of Pleasantville.
What?
Yeah.
Why didn't you tell me this?
How about I talk about it at the end of the episode?
Okay, fine. But you have to tell me about it because I'm stressing out.
I will. Yeah, it was really intense, but I won't drag this section out any longer because it's time to talk about who Linda Mann was.
Okay, so we meet 15-year-old Linda Mann. We get a super generic description of her. Quiet but popular, liked school, enjoyed being with friends.
So here's a little bit more color to who she really was. From the book The Blooding, which is mentioned in this episode because the author is actually one of our talking heads throughout, he writes, Linda Rosemary Mann liked everything about growing up. Music, hairstyles, makeup, clothes. She got her share of A's. When she turned 15, she talked about becoming a multilingualist, practicing French, German, and Italian. She wanted to try Chinese and told everyone she would one day travel the entire world. Her mother didn't doubt it for a minute that Linda would do whatever she set out to do. If money for clothes was short, she would babysit to earn money and make her own dresses. I'm just gutted when I read that and all everything about these girls. We talk about two murders in this episode, hers, and then we get to Dawn Ashworth. It's just tragedies like this that you want to punch anyone in the face when they say, what's meant to be will be, or it's God's plan. Okay, says who, Jan?
Yeah. And Peter tells us Linda left her home to visit a friend that night, but you have a note in here that there is a little more to that, correct?
Yeah, so in that book, it also states that Linda had two babysitting appointments after school, but the second job was actually canceled because the child's mother didn't have to go into work that day for some reason. So now remember, this is 1983. We're not even alive, Drew.
Oh my God, are you calling me young? The Botox is working.
Yeah, but my own memories of us even using a phone versus, you know, the days like we would just walk to a friend's house and knock on the door and ask them to play. Like, even those memories are very, very limited, you know, because it didn't last very long. Phones popped right up for us, you know, at a young age, and then it just became like a really dominant part of our culture. So to even like go back to the early 90s was hard for me to have reference for. But then if you think 10 years, a whole 10 years before this, a whole decade before, phones were probably used even way less to just make a phone call to, you know, to make a change of plans, which is why we find out that, you know, this other babysitting mom, the child's parent, was just outside waiting to meet Linda to tell her like, hey, change of plan. And it probably wasn't, we just have to put that point of reference, is that it probably wasn't common to just use the phone for something like that. So after that, all of her plans changed. She spontaneously decided to then visit friends. She even told her mom that she will be at her friend Karen's for a while, then might stop to see Caroline. Her mother is quoted in the book saying, independent, when discussing Linda, the child is so independent.
Oh my God, that's so sad.
I know.
And when Linda didn't return by midnight, her parents called the police, but unfortunately early the next morning is when the hospital worker finds her body along a secluded footpath that is known locally as the Black Pad. Then we meet Detective David Baker.
He tells us in his very gentle British accent that her clothing was in the state of disarray. Her jeans removed and her underclothes were scattered about. He first mentions how cold it was that night and then mentions the scarf they found around her neck. Then he says that it was used to strangle her. Then another guy pops up. He's rocking some stylish perm mullet that, you know, somehow made its way back into fashion these days. But he says these two lines. She was sexually assaulted. She was brutally attacked.
Word travels fast in this town about Linda's murder, and naturally the town was horrified. Then, guys just keep popping up on the screen to give their opinions, but we don't learn their name or how they're connected to the case. So an old white dude who looks kind of like Dumbledore in a suit literally says,
"The absence of injury to her private parts, and also generally on her body, there was very little injury to her, would suggest that it was not a violent attack, and that she may have died very quickly."
Y'all, then the next line says,
"The conclusion was that she was strangled and then raped."
Sir, please Wingardium Leviosa yourself a dictionary and open to the S pages. Drulexa, define murder by strangulation.
"Assault strangulation. To compress a person's neck, thereby obstructing the person's blood flow or ability to breathe, or doing so with the intent to obstruct the person's blood flow or ability to breathe."
Drulexa, is strangling someone violent?
Abso-fucking-lutely.
It's settled. Moving on.
We now learn about the semen evidence that is found, and it will be extremely important in this case. The B-roll footage shows a Q-tip and a tube. Okay. Because we're going back and forth between, like, the beginning of when this show aired to the very end, it just seems so, like, wow, we're seeing the end of, like, how this whole DNA process has, like, completely become to then the very beginning of when people are starting to discover, like, how tests are done. And the fact that it's just a simple little Q-tip that I feel like I use for my ears in the morning, and it just seems crazy to me.
I know. And with only 1983 technology, the semen sample is able to tell us, though, that it came from a person with type A blood. But this matched 10% of the whole adult male population in England at the time.
Linda's body was also found really close to the local psychiatric hospital, so the rumor mill ran with their speculations about a patient being the murderer. We then meet another old guy with no lower third to tell us his name, and he tells us that he was very anxious to clear those rumors up because he says it was more likely to be a man who was just living a normal life. And that's what I'm here for, sir. I want to know why. Why do you think this?
And now we meet former cop turned author, Joseph Wamba. He's the one who wrote the book that I referenced earlier, but he says the next thing with his whole chest.
"They put more into a murder investigation over there, which they call an inquiry, than we do here because they have so few murders compared to us."
Yeah, I don't know if that makes you feel any type of way, but it got my mind running just a little bit. But after that, we hear about how the fear of the murderer still being out there made the villagers feel like they were being held hostage. And of course, we have the one person who announces to the world that now, just now, they're locking their doors. The level of ignorant bliss you have to be fully unconscious while you sleep for like 8 to 12 hours with your doors unlocked, that is something my mind can't even begin to comprehend.
On the day of the funeral, police decided to set up surveillance to look at who was coming in and out of the funeral because they said it's normal for a murderer to revisit the scene of the crime or some other activity associated with it.
These cops were on top of it for 1983. But despite their best efforts, the case goes completely cold. And that search would last another 3 years before anything changes.
On the afternoon of July 31st, 1986, 15-year-old Dawn Ashworth is walking home from her part-time job at a newsstand. But instead of taking the main road, she took a shortcut down that thickly overgrown footpath called 10 Pound Lane. When she didn't return by 9:30 p.m. that night, her parents called the police.
We don't learn about this in the episode, but that book, The Blooding, it goes into more detail again on everyone who's involved in this case, specifically mentioning the details surrounding her disappearance. So I'm going to go into that just for a little bit so we can get a better picture of Dawn and who she was. So Dawn Ashworth was a reliable, likable girl who seemed to know everyone in the village. That summer, Dawn began going out every night to her friends' homes, and her parents didn't really like her being out so much, but Dawn had agreed to always being home by 9:30. On the morning of July 31st, Robin, her father, woke his daughter to go to her job. She was a bit cross, it says, with him and grumpy, complaining that he should have woken her earlier. And she had this part-time job that summer working at a news agent shop. I don't know what that means exactly in like English terms. I don't know if that's like a bodega or if it's just a stand. I don't know. It's in Enderby though. And that town is connected through this footpath that we learn about. And she was spending her money on all sorts of fashion magazines and clothes. Her home was only a few minutes minutes away from the shop that she worked at, and after receiving her wages around 3:30, Dawn, she walked home. She told her mother she was going to have tea with her friends, Sue and Sharon, and they lived in Narbra. Barbara told Dawn to be home by 7 because the family was going to a birthday party for a friend's little boy. This little boy Dawn often babysat for as well. So it was a family friend. Now, the most direct route to the homes of her friends in Narbra was by the way of this footpath. Now, this is a separate footpath than the one we just learned about. Now, Dawn had frequently been warned about the village footpaths by her parents. She and her dad is quoted saying, "She was aware that there was a killer about. Dawn was years ahead of herself and never queried important rules. She was well acquainted with the Linda Mann case." At first, when she didn't come home in time for the birthday party, they hoped she had just forgotten, so they went out searching for her but couldn't find her anywhere. Robin and Barbara wanted to call the police right away, but then they realized they would be asked, you know, what time does Dawn usually come home? And so they ended up waiting until 9:30 p.m. And when Dawn did not come home, that's when they called the police. The police, though, they didn't take her missing persons case seriously at first. They just chalked it up to her being a runaway and that she will most likely just come back on her own. But her parents knew better. Parents always know better. Listen to the parents. They know their kid. And I'm sure parents would love to be like, oh, this is part of, you know, their behavior. They'll do this all the time. Trust, they'd rather it be that. So listen to the parents. Oh, God, it makes me so mad. But this is a pattern that we find a lot with police officers doing this. But we know better now. And we know that those first 24 hours are crucial. I mean, hell, the first 2 to 3 hours are crucial. I don't know how I'll ever let my kids out of my eyesight ever again. But anyways, one part that just hit me in the heart was an exchange between the officers and her parents. The officer needed a photo for the press, and they saw one of Dawn and asked, "Is this a good likeness?" Her mother replied, "She hates that one, but it's a good enough likeness." And the officer said, "Oh, when she gets back, she'll be annoyed at you for giving us this photograph, won't she?" And then they asked, "Dawn wears a brace on her upper teeth?" And then she responded, "She's worn it for a year. She'll be having the brace taken off very soon. On August 13th, she'll be happy about that," said the policeman. Just makes me so sad. So during this time, the Ashworths then got phone calls from someone who wouldn't speak on the other line. And then after minutes of her parents just frantically begging the person to bring Dawn home or please don't hurt her, they would just hang up. And exactly 14 hours later at 12:55 p.m., the phone rang again and the person still refused to speak. The police suspect that the person who was doing this might be doing some sort of shift work, calling when they were going to and from work. They stayed and took a similar call for them at 4:30 again that afternoon. So I didn't have time to read the whole book. I scanned through that thing, though, up and down, trying to find out if they ever got answers to that, and I couldn't find anything. But that just, I can't imagine how haunting. And if it wasn't the killer, fuck that person.
Then Saturday, the 2nd of August, police see only fingertips from one hand under a ton of heavy brush, including hay and tree branches, and they find the body of Dawn Ashworth. Like Linda Mann, Dawn Ashworth had been strangled and sexually assaulted. And then, of course, Dumbledore is here back to tell us.
Dawn had quite marked injuries to her genital area, which would indicate it was a very violent attack. And her injuries elsewhere in the body would also indicate that she had suffered violent injury, therefore she'd been attacked violently, which would indicate that she had put up a fair struggle before she died.
Again, they collect semen samples, and they are able to match the blood type to the sample collected from Linda's body. But then they talk about all the similarities between the two cases, and the author is back, that Joe author, and he lists off the most generic similarities he could think of. Both girls were teenagers. Both girls were walking alone. Both girls were girls. And he does this shrug like, I don't know. Well, Joe, you literally wrote the book on it, so you should.
Then cut right to no bullshit Bobby.
Both manually strangled. Both severely sexually assaulted.
Both came from the same locality. They were both found in similar circumstances.
And both girls attended the same school.
Okay, then our mullet man is back, and did you hear what this man says about the community after the second murder?
Well, after the second murder, fear really took over. I mean, fear essentially grabbed them by the throat and squeezed the life out of them. Two young girls have been killed. Families didn't know who was going to be next.
You can literally see this man take a millisecond to think, just a millisecond, to think of that line, then deliver it, and with the smuggest look on his face, you can tell he's just like, You see what I did there? What the fuck?
I mean, come on. Do we really need that analogy for this right now? Come on, Mullet Man. Be better.
Then we hear that girls were told to travel in groups, never walk alone, as if that hasn't been what it's been like to exist as a woman in the world since the beginning of time.
Now police launch an extensive investigation, and within a week, they actually got a break. Witnesses saw a young man in the vicinity of 10 Pound Lane on the afternoon of Dawn Ashford's death, who we find out was 17-year-old Richard Buckland, who was, in my opinion, does not look 17. Like, he looks a lot older. When I found out he was 17, I was like, okay, I don't fully believe that, but here we are. We find out that Richard was a kitchen worker at the psychiatric hospital located just a few hundred yards from where both Linda and Dawn had been murdered. Police bring Richard in for questioning, and he quickly became their prime suspect because he actually knew details of the murder which were not in the newspapers. And once he was questioned, he could not account for his movements on that afternoon. Hello, Richard is definitely the killer.
Yeah, I think you're right on this one, because the episode brushes over this man way too lightly. And everything you even see in the news, like articles I could find, a lot of them just mention his learning difficulties. And listen, I have no doubt about that. But going back to that book, there are details about Richard Buckland that tell us that he was not just scaring girls like they reference in the episode of that, oh, he liked to scare girls around town. No. And he didn't just have a learning disability. This man was a full-blown pedophile who raped a 9-year-old child multiple times. So he's 17. She's 9. He rapes her more than once. And she didn't have the understanding to know what was happening to her, or that, you know, she did nothing wrong. So she never was given any support to navigate the multiple traumatic assaults that were inflicted upon her by this creep. One instance, let me tell you about this. One instance included him walking into her home where it was just her and her 8-year-old brother, and the little boy ran upstairs, terrified of him crying. He attacked the child. He attacked this 9-year-old. And she fought like hell. When her screaming, when I say attacked her, he like physically attacked her. She was on the ground. He was taking her clothes off and everything. And when her screaming and the brother's crying got so loud and everything, I think it freaked him out that it would create a lot of attention. That's when he ended up running out of the house. But that wasn't the first time it happened. And I guess he was friends with her older brother. So he used the excuse like, oh, I'm going to wait here until your older brother gets home. There are multiple things that happened to this poor little girl, and all that happened, and the parents didn't know any of it until Richard was actually arrested for the murder we're talking about now, Dawn's murder. And there were just so many instances where even the 9-year-old girl was in public and he was caught with his hands down her pants. And even though that poor child didn't tell her parents, people all around the town knew this. And they knew it was a thing that you could expect from Richard. All of that leads me here to say a very quick and possibly the only true crime class of this episode. And that is, the reason we now teach our children anatomically correct terms for their body is because you can't prosecute a predator if the victim doesn't use legal terms for where and how they were assaulted. So this child, for example, that Richard raped, she used terms like put his finger in me money box and things like that. And it just, that right there tells you a lot about like where her only information about anatomy knowledge and sexual knowledge or anything like that, body boundaries, where that knowledge is coming from. And it's not coming from a trusted adult who is there to protect her. So there is the core reason of why it is so important to teach your children anatomically correct terms about their body, body boundaries, you know, and things of like what is not okay, and make sure that you are always in control of your reactions to when they tell you big things so that they feel safe coming to you to tell you those big things, because that is just so sad. It's so, that part of the book just, ugh. So I hate that it just brushes over him and the crimes he did commit, because to be completely honest, when I was doing all the research for this, I kept seeing, oh, it's the first murder that was solved using DNA and also the first man who was exonerated for murder using DNA. And I was like, well, fuck that exoneration. I'm getting all mad because the way people talked about his crimes and the way we would talk about them now and understand them now is his escalation of his behavior and how extremely violent of of a predator he is as well. And he most definitely, without the DNA, probably, yes, would have been charged with this and they would have thought it was solved. So I am happy that they were able, you know, to expose both. But let's also include what level of trash can and dirtbag this man is.
After 15 long hours of questioning, Richard finally confesses to the rape and murder of Dawn Ashworth, but not Linda Mann. The police were convinced, though, that Richard also killed Linda because of all the similarities, but Buckland ended up denying that he actually killed Linda.
So in order to lock down the case against Richard, the local officers are looking into everything. And ironically enough, just down the street at the University of Leicester, less than 10 miles away, Dr. Alec Jeffries, a geneticist who's been researching hereditary diseases and paternity testing, accidentally just discovered DNA genetic profiling. Just, you know, fell upon it.
Y'all, Forensic Files got Alec Jeffries. And do we all remember RFLP testing that we covered in our sixth episode? Well, this is the man who invented it. I'm not sure why they didn't make this the first episode of Forensic Files.
I know. It kind of would just like set us off right with all the knowledge of like where this DNA is coming from. But I also want to know why it's not streaming with the rest of the episodes out there, because I think it's kind of an important episode to kind of explain the origin of it. But anyways, this episode does an awesome job explaining RFLP testing, and the previous one did not. Not like this. However, Peter's audio is awful. But Drew, would you like to cover RFLP testing with me for the people?
Let's do it. Restriction fragment length polymorphism, or RFLP,
can identify an individual based on just a small amount of their DNA.
DNA that can come from semen, blood, hair, roots, and other cells.
DNA is a complex chemical which is present in all living cells.
It's like a little computer program.
And that program contains coded instructions on how to make a human being.
White blood cells from Richard Buckland's blood sample
were treated with a special chemical solution
that allows the DNA,
a sticky white substance.
Peter really said it.
He said it.
A sticky white substance.
Okay, well, it allows it to float free.
The DNA is cut into smaller pieces using special proteins called restriction enzymes.
These act like chemical scissors.
I love this Peter era.
Chemical scissors Peter is my favorite Peter.
The DNA fragments must then be sorted out.
This process is called electrophoresis.
The DNA is then marked with a radioactive dye
and placed in separate lanes on an electrophoretic gel.
Then it's put under an ultraviolet light.
But in 1996, the people had no idea what this was, so how did Peter describe it?
It is subjected to an electric field under ultraviolet light.
The electrical current draws the negatively charged fragments through the gel.
To the positive end of the tray, the separated fragments are
visualized on X-ray film called an ultraradiogram, which resembles a barcode.
And all of this then results with looking at an individual's unique genetic makeup.
Conclusion. Both girls have been raped and therefore presumably murdered by the same man, and that man was not the prime suspect, Richard Buckland.
When they compare the results from Linda and Dawn's cases, they are a match, but they do not match Richard Buckland.
Nope. And even worse is the police didn't charge him with the rape or assault of that little 9-year-old girl. Apparently afterwards, people in town, they just couldn't believe Richard's parents never tried to sue them or make trouble for the local police after they had their son, you know, in custody for 4 months for a crime he didn't commit. But apparently the parents, they didn't know about the other assaults and they were just relieved that he wasn't charged. So they put their heads down and just carried on. It's just disgusting. And that's why they didn't cause like any ruckus, is because they were like, you basically got lucky, you know, and keep going. And it's just disgusting. So anyways, if I had to put my money on it, I bet he probably offended again.
But even the police questioned it and had the samples tested again just to make sure they were accurate. But now they have the murderer's DNA and nothing to test against it. So they just decide to do a genetic dragnet.
No one thought of DNA dragnet? I mean, what a missed opportunity.
Okay, what an interesting name for this type of procedure. It honestly just quickly made me think of RuPaul's Drag Race. Probably just because of the word. DNA Dragnet seems like an event.
Yes!
Yeah, like buy tickets now to the 2023 DNA Dragnet. just seems crazy. But anyways, a DNA dragnet is where they actually asked for volunteers of all men in the town to come forward and get a blood sample taken to be used to go against the DNA samples to see if there was a match. And only the men's samples who actually have the same blood type that were previously tested were used to look at. Well, even though they've narrowed the suspects down to about 10% and they had over 5,000 men voluntarily submit samples, they don't even get a single match. And it's incredibly disappointing.
But y'all know the saying, only two people can keep a secret if one of them is dead.
Apparently, a man named Colin Pitchfork offered another man named Ian Kelly $200 to submit DNA for him, giving a bullshit story that Colin already submitted it for someone else who had a record, and Colin actually didn't trust the police.
It says police already knew him because of a prior conviction of indecent exposure. Y'all, this man raped a 16-year-old in a field in 1979 and another one between the murders of Linda and Don. It is appalling how these violent crimes are just brushed away and diminished, and we wonder why violence against women is such a chronic problem. The indecent exposure charge happened when he was 14 and flashing teenage girls. So much more is missing between the first charge and the murder of Linda and Don.
Colin pulled off some old school shit to swap out his ID photo for Ian. They went to a photo booth to get their passport photos taken. Do we all remember photo booths? Like the OG photo booths.
Oh, I love a good photo booth photo shoot. Oh, I remember getting all ready for the movies just to get those freaking photos.
Oh my gosh, with the popcorn and everything. But Colin just managed to get Ian's photo in there, and the police didn't even look any further into it. So a whole year after Don's murder, when Ian starts blabbing his mouth, they finally have an answer as to why that silly DNA RuPaul's dragnet didn't produce any suspects.
A young woman who is the hero of this story overheard that conversation at the pub, and she is me and I am her, and you better believe she called up that murder tip line and led them straight to Colin Pitchfork.
He also worked at the bakery, but Ian Kelly didn't live in the area, so his name wasn't on the list of local men they were requesting samples from. So Colin made up a lie, told him he already submitted DNA for the other person, but who cares? It doesn't matter.
Nope, does not matter. I don't care what his excuse was. Doesn't matter. Once they found Colin and told him, hey, we know about the plan that you orchestrated, that gave them enough probable cause to just get a search warrant for his DNA. And apparently Colin had been keeping up with the news about the advances in technology, so he understood what they were saying about the fact that, like, they're gonna get my DNA no matter what I do. And he did believe that at the time that DNA profiling was as good as it gets and that they were gonna catch him. So he gave it up and he confessed.
He was only 27 years old, but married and had two kids. And get this, no one in his family had a single clue. They were all shocked.
But personally, I don't believe that for a second. And I'm not saying that they knew he was a serial killer, but if that show, Evil Lives Here, taught me anything, families of predators, they are usually victims of them as well, just in different ways. And I dug and dug and dug for more information about his family, but no one talked to the press. So I do feel like they just put some generic statement out there about how, like, oh, the family didn't know, they were all so surprised, which of course, like, you find out they're a serial killer, yeah, everyone's gonna be shocked, and that's completely traumatizing, and it's a completely traumatic event in your life. But his ex-wife is quoted once in The Sun, and she says, I've never spoken about it in 33 years because whatever I say would be glorified, and I'm not going to change my mind now, it would serve no purpose. I don't really know what she means about, like, I'm not going to change my mind, but she does describe Pitchfork as a monster. This predator murdered Linda while his baby son was still in the car. Then he drove home and put the baby to bed. The monstrous yet totally in control behavior, that's what my nightmares are made of.
Oh my God, that is terrible. I didn't know that.
Yeah. His baby son was in the car while he was murdering
her. Ugh, it makes me feel weird.
Which also, though, I just thought of this. Her being a babysitter, that could have been so disarming to see a man with his baby.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that just made me sick.
Oh, my God. On January 22nd, 1988, Colin Pitchfork became the first person ever to be convicted in a murder case solved by DNA profiling and was sentenced to life in prison. And for his part, Ian Kelly was convicted of conspiracy to pervert justice and sentenced to an 18-month prison sentence, which actually was suspended and he never served a day.
Now we get multiple sound bites of all those old dudes that were just talking heads on this case, and we don't know any of their names besides that author, and I guess Dumbledore. But everyone is just building up Alec Jeffries, and rightfully so. You know, that man has seriously impacted just bringing justice to so many people. And you know what? I think it kind of hurt author Joe, because then author Joe says,
people will be talking about this case 100 years from now, not because of my book, but because of Alec Jeffries' discovery.
Seriously, like this guy, I feel like this author is delusional. Like he wants to take the credit for all of this, but he knows that like it's not him, it's Alec Jeffries.
People will be talking about this case for 100 years, not because of my book, but because of Alec Jeffries' discovery.
In 1994, Alec Jeffries was knighted by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II of England for services to science and technology. Yay, Alec Jeffries. Now, is it any time for updates?
Okay, yes. I don't want to give this man any more attention, but I do think it's important for people to know just how important the parole process is. He is, of course, in England, so their system it's very different than what we have here. But had people not been paying attention, Colin Pitchfork could have been walking on the streets today. He was sentenced to a minimum of 30 years. Then it was reduced 2 years for making exceptional progress, which, of course, disturbed the victims' families. In 2017, he was moved to an open prison, but he got sent back to the regular prison in 2021 because he was caught allegedly approaching women, young women, driving, watching women, young ladies. I don't know about girls and children. And then he was also caught practicing his breathing to pass a lie detector test.
What?
Weird hobbies, bro. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So he was sent back and then his parole came back up and a private hearing was held in April of 2023. That parole board decided he can be released, stating that all of those allegations that got him sent back to prison had no backing. But a minister, which I'm guessing is equivalent to like a U.S. judge, this minister somehow intervened and now a Lord Chancellor has to review it. So this minister intervened, blocked it, and now because of the block, it has to go through this other process and all this stuff. So this man is only 61. He needs more time to rot on this earth before he's like no longer a threat, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and his release, it has caused a lot of controversy in the U.K., so it actually inspired this creation of the Victims and Prisoners Bill. This bill is to give ministers the power to block the release of serious offenders. It's currently on the committee stage, and this case apparently is what has inspired it, but it's, you know, no decisions have been met or no decisions have been made. Yeah, but that stuff is all in motion to keep him off the streets.
Like, that's recent. That's recent.
That's very recent. I haven't since the latest article was like July 2023 about that. It was approved, but they have to wait for this like Lord Chancellor to review it because this minister was like, no, you need to go back and review this. And there's some motion he like to block it where he's like, you didn't make a clear decision or something. I don't know. And it's so weird looking at pictures I heard in other, you know, podcasts. There is a podcast that I listened to about this case. It's called Murder with My Husband. And the whole thing is like, it's a well-researched podcast. And the whole like premise is he hates it, she loves it, you know, so, and they covered this case and she did a lot of good research. So I have to, props to her for sure. Oh my God. But that is all for episode 8.
Oh my God, that was a big episode. A lot of terminology that we could not say. A lot of pronunciations that we had to get research from Siri to help. Unfortunately, Kenan was not here to help us, but it's okay.
It's okay. You did really well. You did it really, really well. Yeah.
Did I? I don't know.
Did.
I don't know.
I think you did. I do think these older episodes are really choppy, and so it's very hard to follow the episode and recap this episode while also trying to piece together the story. It's proving to be a little bit difficult. Okay, now for our missing person cases that we would like everyone to know about. From the Black and Missing Foundation's website, Elijah Okulunola is a 24-year-old male who was last seen driving in the area of the 0 to 100th block of East Pearson Street in Chicago, Illinois. He is 5'6", 140 pounds, with dark complexion, brown eyes, and has short black hair. The circumstances of his disappearance are unknown, but he was last seen wearing a thin black jacket, blue jeans, and black and white gym shoes. If you have any information on Elijah's whereabouts or anything involving this case, you are asked to call the Chicago Police Department at 312-747-8274. You can also submit information to the Black and Missing Foundation's tip line at blackandmissinginc.com/tipline.
And from the Bureau of Indian Affairs.gov is the missing person case of Michelle Elbowshield. Michelle Elbowshield went missing in September of 2023 and was last known to be in Rapid City, South Dakota. She is described as having brownish colored hair, brown eyes, and was last seen wearing a blue sweater, black jeans. Is 4'10 and about 100 pounds. She is of American Indian or Alaska Native descent, coming from the Ogala Sioux tribe. If you have any information regarding Michelle's whereabouts or know of any information that could be helpful for this case, you are asked to contact Rapid City Police Department and BIA OJS Missing and Murder Unit at 605-394-4131. Or you can also submit case information or tips to the BIA one of three ways. Text all capital letters BIAMMU and your tip to 847-411. Or call in tips to 1-833-560-2065 or email capital letters OJS_MMU@BIA.gov.
We will also post the case information on our Instagram at Forensic Files Podcast. But first, please go and follow at Black and Missing FDN and at MMI Who Is Missing. Thank you. Episode 8. Sorry, it was extremely late.
Oh, sorry, you guys. Sorry, we are dealing with life. We are dealing with squirrels. We are dealing with
dogs with UTIs.
Dogs.
I didn't even know.
We are dealing with it all, and we are sorry. We are sorry, but we are going to be on it.
We are. You know what, you guys? We are collaborating and coming up with ideas to just get more content out there and more storytelling between Drew and I of sharing these stories. It's something that we really are passionate about, and we also love working together on these things. So we are talking about launching a Patreon for bonus content, even though we can't get our regular content together. Listen, we have a plan. I promise
we have a plan.
This is a learning journey for the both of us. But yeah, so stay tuned for more on that.
We're gonna keep going, and like we can't talk about it yet, but we're so excited about like the ideas of and what's to come. I'm so thankful for all of you, for the ones that have listened and downloaded.
Please share with your friends and everything. We are those like small content creators that, you know, we're just doing it ourselves. We don't have like that big network behind us, but we are trying our best to, you know, get these stories out there with, you know, a new energy behind them and updates and lessons.
And thank you so much for understanding our little bit of a late break, but it's going to be so worth it. Okay, wait. But can you tell me the story about someone being shot dead?
Okay, yeah. So it was a domestic dispute. The wife shot her husband in self-defense because he was trying to actually break into the home the night before their court date for a divorce.
What?
And she, yeah, so she, okay, so we lived in this town 30 miles north of Atlanta, so very removed from the hustle bustle of the city. It's straight up suburbia, looks like Pleasantville, and it was actually the day after Thanksgiving because Blake and I had gotten back from Thanksgiving. He realized he had forgotten something in my car, and so he ran outside to go get it, and while he was coming back inside, the neighbor's friend, and he had known her, he had lived there for a while now, he knew her, she approached him and was like, hey, if you see the neighbor, can you call the police? You know, he's, we got a restraining order against him. They're getting a divorce, blah, blah, blah. I mean, she just came in hot, with all the details, everything. Blake was like, whoa. Like, I'm just getting out of the car. Like, I just ate my weight in turkey. Like, I want to go to bed. And it was so weird, you know, to have only neighbor pleasantries with someone and like see their friends at like random times, but and to recognize them versus like get dumped all this information is very, very different. He had no idea, and he's like, okay, like, and all due respect, like, I have no idea what's going on. And he even said, he's like, if she wants to come and talk to me and tell me, I am open to have that conversation, but you know, I'm not just gonna involve myself and call the police. Like, I don't know what's going on. The next day, I'm supposed to meet for the first time my sister-in-law. Oh my God. We were having them over for dinner. And I remember I was downstairs in the kitchen. I had baked a pie.
You baked a pie?
Yes, I bake a very good apple pie.
Oh my God, you make a pie?
I'm a really good baker. I love baking.
Oh my God, then we should make our own bakery because I love baking too.
I love baking. I can't claim this recipe though. Brianna, my friend Brianna's grandma's recipe actually. I remember I was like rushing. The sink was running. I was rushing to clean everything up. And I remember looking at the clock because I heard a big bang. And I didn't know what it was. The water's running. Everything was kind of distorted. But I remember thinking like, oh crap, they're here. And you know, I'm running late. So I had just looked at the clock and I have this weird photographic memory with numbers. I could remember exactly it was 6:07. Like I just remember because I looked right and I was like, ah, I'm 7 minutes late. And so I was rushing. And when no one came through the door or anything, I thought the other place my mind went was like, oh, it was Blake must have like dropped the toilet seat bowl. Like you don't think it's a gunshot. Blake comes, I hear like, boom, 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 boom. He comes down the stairs. He's like, so someone just shot something. He's like, gunfire just went off. Like, he's like all over the place. He's like, I think the dog got shot. And I was like, whoa, 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 what? What? Blake was like, I'm going to call my brother because his brother and his sister were supposed to come. And our driveway was like, our driveway is directly across. He's like, I don't want them coming here right now. I don't know what's going on. I just saw him run away from the house. I think he shot the dog. I'm not sure. And I was just like, what the hell? And so he saw him run to the woods. Well, his brother ended up making it through to the house in time. But we called his sister and like, don't come. So his brother's now here. And we all like sneak up to the top window because Blake was upstairs. And we did not have blinds at the time. We just had curtains and all the curtains were open. Our two front rooms, those windows looked right into the house across the street, which was their house. They didn't have blinds. So like all their windows are open and the lights are off though. So the cops, we see the cops coming, you know, it's like straight out of a movie. They have their gun, but they got the flashlight on top and you just see the flashlight going through room, 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 room. They're looking for him. And so we see his wife, ex-wife, and we see her friend. We see the dog and we're like, wait. The dog's
so
fine.
They shoot.
And we're like, who got shot? Well, then we see, because the ambulance is there, the cops are there, fire trucks came. We see a stretcher come out of the woods and Craig is on it.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So they put him into the stretcher and they did turn on the sirens and they drive away. CSI comes. No joke. CSI is like, full blown on the back of their coats. They're putting up the little number.
No way.
Like, I swear to God, I probably still have photos. Because I just couldn't believe it. I was like, what? I was like sending it to my mom, right? I was like, this is literally happening right now. What happened is I remember seeing the stretcher come out of the woods and I saw Craig's arm fall off the stretcher. And they lifted it back up and put it on him. And I said to Blake and Troy, I was like, he's dead. That does not look like he's alive. But then they turn on the siren and we're like, oh, well, then maybe he is alive, you know. And
right,
you know, they were supposed to get a divorce the next day. And they did take her to the police station. They didn't put her in handcuffs or anything. They took both of them in the back of the car and they drove off. So we did not know what was going on, like at all. Turns out he was dead. They turned on the siren. So the people like me peering over my windowsill, you know, wouldn't just start like the whole rumor mill of like, he's dead, It was just. So I guess that's a thing that ambulances will do for like 30 seconds until they're out of the area is they'll turn on the siren while they drive away so that you don't know if they're, you know, dead or
so alive. She killed her husband.
So what happened is she did have a TPO order, temporary protective order against him. This man parked down the street. So it was a very small community. And then there was like a short little driveway into our neighborhood. And then there was another street. It dead ended over here. So he parked his truck down here, walked through the woods, tried breaking into the house the night before they were supposed to get a divorce. Who knows what he planned on doing? I have no idea. You could speculate for days. I don't know if it was to be violent or to get stuff. I don't know. But she had a TPO order for a reason, right? And she shot him. And what Blake saw, because he was upstairs, he looked up, seeing this commotion happen between them right outside our windows. And what he saw was Craig get shot, kind of crunch over and run off to the woods. Blake was the last person to see him alive. Yeah, so the police came the next day to the door asking to talk to Blake. I was like shaking. I was home alone and I like let them into the house and I like sat that down and I was like, do you guys want some water? Like I went into like full blown, like this is all I've just seen this on TV. I don't know what's happening. Yeah. Full blown like the movies.
So what happened?
So she came home the next day. She approached Blake and told him, you know, kind of like, all she said was like, I'm really sorry you saw that. I don't know if she knew he's seen or she just assumed everybody did, you know. But the cops did say they wanted to talk to Blake. And I think they just wanted to talk to Blake to kind of corroborate what she was saying happened. And it was interesting because Blake's like, I don't want to talk. You know, like Blake's like the last person that wants to get involved. And but yeah, he called them back because they just gave me his their card and they're like, just have your husband call us. And he's like, this is what I saw. And, you know, I didn't really understand what was going on. And they're like, OK, that lines up. Yeah, she just moved right back into her house. And
so she killed him and got away with it.
So then listen to this. So his parents then, his dad, I don't know if his dad was in some sort of law enforcement. So then his parents were trying really hard to, I don't know if they were trying to do like a wrongful death suit or what, but they were really trying to get some justice for him, thinking he deserved some sort of justice. I don't know all the ins and outs. I don't. I really, truly don't. It sounded very messy. But this was the neighbor that Blake would be like, hey, you know, I'm going out of town. Will you keep an eye on the house? Danielle's home alone. Turns out he had a record for breaking into an airport, a private airport, stealing parts and stuff. And I think that was a felony. Blake's just, you know, he's asking a felon to watch the house. And Blake then wanted to know why I wanted a security system.
I am shook.
I have a lot of other stories. Oh my gosh.
This is crazy. Why are you holding off until this episode to tell me this?
Background checks on your neighbors, everybody. That was the one neighbor, too, that Blake thought he had a friendship with. We bought our vacuum from him, actually.
No way.
Yeah, we still have that vacuum.
From Craig?
It's a really good fucking vacuum.
Is it a Dyson?
It is.
Don't throw out a Dyson.
Never.
Never.
I need some sage now. I need to, like, clear the energy. This aura needs to find a new home. But, okay, our next episode is episode 19 from season 14. It is called Skeleton Key.
Oh, my God. This is one of my favorite movies.
There's a movie?
Oh, my God, you have to watch it. It's called The Skeleton Key. It is one of my favorite scary movies.
You know what's funny is I always think that you hear these titles and you're just like, I'm so excited because you're anticipating a horror film.
Yes, and
about ghosts, like not about not murder.
Well, no, some of them are about murders. I mean, like this last one was the footpath murders. Like that sounded really interesting to me because it sounds like a scary movie where someone walks down a path.
But that's what I mean. Exactly. You're like projecting, you're like thinking of a scary movie and yeah.
Well, there is actually a scary movie called The Skeleton.
But now there actually is a skeleton. Yeah, now there actually is a movie and now it makes sense of like, when you hear these titles.
And you must watch it.
If you like our podcast, please help us spread the word, share on social media, share on Reddit, share everywhere, and drop a review to tell us what you think.
And if you don't want to, hey, it's okay. Have a nice day and sashay away.
Until the next one.
Bye.